I was 16 years old, standing on the top of Pikes Peak for the first time. As I turned and looked to the west, there were an endless series of mountain peaks as far as the eye could see, Purple Mountain's majesty. When I turned and looked back to the east, there was the city of Colorado Springs below at the foot of the mountain, and out beyond that, the Great Plains that comprise the middle of the United States, flat farmland as far as the eye could see, amber waves of grain. I had never seen anything like this before. Then the tour guide told us that Kathleen Lee Bates was standing in this very place, seeing these very scenes, when she was inspired to write the words of America the Beautiful. You know the song, right? Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed great grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. America is so beautiful, and we are so blessed to live here. But we also know that when we come down off the mountaintop and walk the streets of Colorado Springs or any other city, town, or hamlet, the truth is, up close and personal, we see we've also got big problems. Problems that have come into especially sharp focus over these recent months, causing many of us, the spirit within us, to be stirred up, causing many of us to say, we need change and we need it now. Many of us finding the prophetic spirit within us is stirred up, an inflection point for America, a moment of opportunity. We want to seize that moment. The prophetic spirit within us is stirred up. Yesterday, we celebrated Independence Day. A couple weeks ago, Juneteenth. It's that time of year when we think a lot about our nation and what it means for us to become a more perfect union, to live more closely into our ideals. So, to those who are restless for progress, to those who believe that everyone is equal and should be able to live like it, to those who want to take prophetic action to help make that happen today, I want to encourage you. Today, I want to feed your spirit for what lies ahead. We typically think of prophets as being people who predict the future, and sometimes they do. Actually, though, the great prophets of Israel were far more concerned with the present than with the future. By definition, a prophet is someone who delivers a message from God that's uncomfortable to hear in hopes of creating positive change. That's exactly what the great prophets of the Old Testament did. They loved their nation, Israel, so much, and they believed so deeply in their nation's divine destiny that they weren't willing to let their nation fall short of God's high ideals. And so the prophets of old, they had a message that was often uncomfortable. That's what they did, and that's what we, who would be God's prophets in our time, are called to do in our place and in our nation. So, my fellow prophets, if you feel called to be a change agent for God in our time, in our place, today I want to encourage you. I want to feed your spirit by sharing three great biblical lessons that every prophet who wants to be effective needs to know. Sometimes it feels like we're spinning our wheels, right? One of you sent me the other day an internet meme that's going around that said, life is short, so make sure you spend as much time as possible on the internet arguing with strangers about politics. Many times we probably find ourselves thinking, there must be something better I can do than having ad infinitum arguments with crazy people on the internet. Today, let's talk about what that is, starting with a prayer. God, in the Bible, you say, behold, I make all things new. You are constantly creating change, restless for progress, and we want to be your prophetic partners in that endeavor. Show us how. We ask in Jesus' holy name. Amen. When I was a young adult living in Washington, D.C., I was sitting at the kitchen table in my apartment one day having lunch, reading the Washington Post, when I turned the page and was suddenly confronted with a photograph of a starving Ethiopian child. I cringed and thought to myself, good grief, I don't want to see that. I'm having lunch. How could I enjoy my lunch if I'm staring at a photograph of a starving child? I don't want to think about that right now. So I quickly flipped the page. Only to hear God saying to me, Jeff, when will you have time? So I turned the page back. I tore out the photograph and the associated article. I folded it up and I put it in my briefcase. I was due to take a trip to New York that week, and so I promised God that on the train up or on the train back, I would read that article and think about that photograph. On the way up to New York, I just got too busy preparing for my meeting. But when I got on the train to come back, I knew that the procrastination had to end because, after all, I had made a promise. So I pulled the article and the photograph out of my briefcase. I read the article, and then I forced myself to stare at the photograph of that starving little boy, skeletal, skin and bones, staring listlessly into the camera, too weak to speak. I forced myself to stare at his photograph for 10 or 15 minutes. I wept. I thought to myself, God, I'm one person. What can I do? How could I ever make a dent? Then I thought to myself, God, someday if you let me become a pastor, and at this point in my life I was feeling called in that direction, I said, God, if you'll let me become a pastor someday, I promise you that I'll challenge my congregation to work collectively together to do something meaningful for starving children. I looked at the photograph of that little boy and I said to him, I will remember you. I promise. 12 years later, as the relatively new pastor of this church, I had the opportunity to challenge us to form a partnership with Child Fund International. That was almost 17 years ago now. And over the course of that time, we have continuously supported 30 to 35 different impoverished children across the globe, raising a whole generation of children, and now we're working on our second generation, and over the course of that time, we've invested more than $170,000 in the life and the well-being of those children. I am so grateful for a congregation whose heart is so big, for a congregation who cares. But I tell you that story because it brings us to the, it points us to the first key lesson that we've got to learn if we want to be effective prophets for God's change in our world, in our nation today. That first key lesson being, prophets are people who choose to feel the pain of those who suffer rather than living in denial. Whenever we are confronted with something that is difficult and painful, it's just a normal human impulse to want to flip the page, to want to turn away, to want to minimize and rationalize that it's really not that bad. Because if we had to admit to ourselves that it was really that bad, we know that we wouldn't be able to live with ourselves unless we did something about it. So it's just much easier to turn away and to live in denial. Put on a happy face. Think happy thoughts. Maybe that will make it go away. Get on the internet and watch funny pet videos. It'll make you feel better. Speaking of which, one of you recently sent me the funniest pet video I have ever seen. A dog found its owner's dentures. Watch what happens.
My love.
Isn't that hilarious? It's too bad that life can't always be like that. Too bad that we can't always walk around with a big smiley face. Happy, happy, think positive thoughts. Don't get me wrong. We need joy and laughter and happiness in our lives. But to live well, we have to find that sacred balance between feeling the joy and feeling the pain. That's what the great prophets of the Old Testament did. They weren't willing to turn away from the pain of the dispossessed in Israel. They looked at the pain. They opened their heart to the pain. Amos, for example, was a farmer in Israel at a time of great prosperity in his nation. The rich were getting richer, but the poor were getting poorer. Amos did not want to be a prophet, but he couldn't bring himself to look away. He forced himself to see the suffering of the dispossessed in Israel, how hard their life was, and seeing it and feeling it, he had to do something about it, and so he became a champion. He became an advocate, and he began sharing with his fellow citizens provocative messages that they didn't much like to hear. He said to them things like Amos 8:4, "Hear this, you who trample on the needy and bring to ruin the poor of the land, saying, 'When will the new moon be over so that we may sell grain? When will the Sabbath be over so that we may offer wheat for sale? We will make the measuring cup small and the shekel great, and practice deceit with false balances, buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals.'" You see, Amos wasn't willing to turn the page. He wasn't willing to look away. He wanted his nation Israel to live into God's ideals. And he knew that to get there, he was going to have to get his fellow citizens to see what was really happening and open their hearts to the pain. And so he did his best with his words to vividly paint the picture of the suffering that was taking place. I think that's why the death of George Floyd impacted us so much. It was as if God was saying to us, "Watch this video." And we said, "God, I'm having lunch right now. I don't have time to think about that." And God says, When will you have time to think about it? So we forced ourselves to watch. All 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And like the photograph that as a young adult I stared at on that train, that video broke our hearts and outraged our spirits and caused us to say, I gotta stop living in denial. We got a problem here. I want to share with you some statistics. Before I do that, though, I want to remind us of what the Bible says in James 3:17. Wisdom that is from above is easy to be entreated. That's in the old King James. I love that King James phrase, easy to be entreated. When you entreat someone, that means you plead with them. That means you make your case to them. This verse tells us that if we're living in the Spirit of God, if we're connected to the wisdom of God, we're going to be the kind of person who's easy to be entreated. That means when someone says something difficult to us, instead of being defensive, we listen with an open heart. My prayer is that we can be the kind of people who are easy to be entreated. So I invite you to open your heart to listen to the statistics I'm about to share in a spirit that's easy to be entreated. Did you know that Black Americans are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by the police than white Americans? That's a 250% difference, and that's just a fact. Did you know that Black Americans are 3 times more likely to die of COVID than white Americans? That's a 300% difference. Did you know that 50% of all uninsured Americans are people of color? Did you know that little Black babies are twice as likely to die in their first year of life as little white babies? That's a 200% difference. Did you know that the average white American family has net worth that is 10 times greater than the average Black American family? Of course, there are exceptions to every rule, but that's the average, a tenfold difference. That's a 1,000% financial difference. Did you know that the wealth gap in America right now is greater, economists tell us, than the wealth gap was in South Africa during apartheid? Those are just facts. Facts that say, we've got a problem. As great as our nation is, great nations don't look away from their problems. They work on their problems. They solve their problems. We got a problem. It is the legacy of slavery and racism. Some may say, Jeff, I don't want to hear it. I didn't tune in today to hear it. I'm going to turn off Facebook right now. I understand that it's hard to hear this. It's painful. We'd rather smile and think about something else. It's painful to hear this. That's why so many of Israel's prophets got killed. But my prayer is that we will be a congregation of people who are easy to be entreated, who have open hearts, that are willing to listen to difficult facts, so that we can make a difference for God, for all of you who listen with open hearts. Thank you. Because that means God can use us to help alleviate the pain. You see, this is the first key step toward becoming an effective prophet. Becoming an effective prophet always begins with empathy. Empathy then, in turn, gives us a sense of urgency for action. So we decide to do something. We take our first steps. Maybe we participate in a protest march, or maybe we contact our elected representatives and demand change. Or maybe we send a little bit of money to a candidate who is saying the right things, or maybe we do all of the above and we get excited and we watch and we wait. And precious little changes. And we find ourselves thinking, why is this taking so long? And we find ourselves getting discouraged. Which brings us to the second great lesson that effective prophets have to learn. If the first lesson is prophets choose to feel the pain of those who suffer rather than living in denial, the second great lesson a prophet has to learn is the process of iterative change. Prophets must understand the process of iterative change. Smartsheet.com defines iterative change like this. Iterative change is a process of continuous improvement. The goal of iteration is to get closer to the solution with each repetition. The end of each iteration becomes the starting point for the next. The iterative process relies on repeated cycles of adjustments. We don't want to hear it, but the truth is, great change usually doesn't take place in one fell swoop. Great change is usually a long and laborious process. Think of it like this. Assume you are passing through Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you have the opportunity to stop at the Blue Stem Bar, where you have a killer dessert that is called Extreme Chocolata Palooza that looks like this. It is to die for. And so you say to the waiter, what's the recipe? He says, sorry, that's a trade secret. But you are undeterred. You are absolutely determined that one way or another, you're going to figure out what is the secret ingredient in this cake that gives it its unusual blue tint and its unique flavor. And so you go home and you start to experiment. You mix together different ingredients in different measures, and then you put it in the oven and you bake it and you taste it, and it's not even close. But you are not discouraged. You are going to find out one way or another. So you mix and match some slightly different ingredients in slightly different measure, put it in the oven, bring it out, test it. Yeah, closer, but still a long way to go. But you are undeterred. You keep repeating the cycle over and over again and again, tweaking, changing as you go, getting ever closer to the perfect dessert. And you know that eventually you will either have the perfect dessert or you will die of a heart attack trying to find it. And either way, it's not a bad way to go, right? Great prophets are like that. Great prophets are absolutely determined that they are in it for the long haul. And they will keep going, and they will keep trying. They will keep mixing, and they will keep measuring until we finally get there. Just ask one of the Bible's all-time great prophets, Elijah. You heard our reading about Elijah a little bit earlier in today's worship service. Elijah was a prophet in Israel at a time when Israel was falling far, far short of its ideals. And Elijah, he had some great successes, but he also had a lot of setbacks. And the truth is, he was spinning his wheels and got so tired that he went out to the wilderness and said, God, I'm done with this. But God renewed his spirit and gave him an understudy, Elisha. Don't get the two confused. There's Elijah, the mentor, Elisha, the mentee. So God gives Elijah, Elisha as a mentee, and Elijah continues forward for the rest of his days, an active prophet, until it comes to the very end of his days. We read about the end of Elijah's days. Both Elijah and his understudy, Elisha, knew that the end was near for Elijah. And so they crossed the Jordan River and they were walking and talking. Our text today tells us the critical part of the story, 2 Kings 2:11, as Elijah and Elisha were walking and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah was carried in a whirlwind into heaven. Can you imagine? And ever since then, in both Jewish and Christian tradition, Elijah has been known as the prophet who never died. He was simply transported in a chariot of fire, no less, to heaven. Meanwhile, his mantle falls from him onto the shoulders of Elisha, who proceeds to minister with a double portion of the spirit and the power of his mentor, Elijah, carrying forward the prophetic work into his generation. But then comes the end of Elisha's days, and still the work is not nearly done. Israel is still a complete mess. So God continues sending prophets to the Israelites, one prophet after another, prophet after another, prophet after another. The whole Old Testament is full of these prophets until we finally get to the last prophetic book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi, and look what it tells us in Malachi 4:5. God says, "Behold, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes." Apparently Elijah's work isn't done. Sure enough, 400 or 500 years later, God sent Elijah back to us in the form of John the Baptist. That's what Jesus tells his disciples in Matthew 11:14. Jesus said to his disciples, "If you're willing to accept it, he," referring to John the Baptist, "is Elijah who is to come." Elijah was preparing the way for Jesus. But then Herod cut off his head. Yeah, that was the end of that, eh? Not so fast, because six chapters later, in Matthew chapter 16, when Jesus is discouraged and needs some encouragement, goes up to the top of the mountain, the Mount of Transfiguration. Guess who appears to Jesus? Elijah. Poor Elijah, every time he's getting settled into heaven, it's like God says, "Oh, by the way, Elijah, one more thing." And back he goes. But still, his work wasn't done, because when we get to the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 11, 4 through 6 indicates that in the end of times, guess who's coming back? Elijah. Everything that's in the Bible is there for a reason. What do you think we're supposed to learn from that Elijah sequence? Maybe it's this: that prophetic change is almost always a long iterative process. That prophetic change almost always requires intergenerational struggle. An ongoing, tough-minded, "I won't give up" struggle is required to make good progress. For example, in 1831 marked the beginning of abolitionism and the Underground Railroad. Great progress, but just the beginning. 30 years later, 1861 marked the Civil War and the beginning of emancipation. A huge leap forward, but still so far to go. 1870 marked the ratification of the 15th Amendment to our Constitution, guaranteeing that voting could not be denied on the basis of race. Important progress, thanks be to God. But it didn't take us long to figure out that people were endlessly inventive in finding different ways that they could come up with to deny the vote despite that constitutional amendment. 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott and the civil rights movement blossoms into full action. A whole multitude of prophets working together, gaining incredible momentum that leads to the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. a huge leap forward. And yet still, there was so much, as we know only too well, remaining to be accomplished. Change is almost always an iterative process. A prophet's work is never done. But with each iteration, we get closer to the ideal. So, if you're a fair weather fan, if you have a short attention span, if you're in this right now just because it's trendy to be in it, don't bother, you won't last. But if you are ready to dig in for the long haul, if you're willing to keep coming back at it again and again like Elijah, never say die, then together we will accomplish great progress in our generation. We will do our generational part in the struggle. Now, hearing all of this, you may be tempted to think, Jeff, being a prophet is not sounding like a very good deal. You've told me that I got to open my heart to a lot of pain in the world, and that on top of that, the struggle is going to be long and hard and difficult. Why would I ever want to become a prophet? What's my motivation? That brings us to the third, the final lesson I want to share with us today about what it means to be an effective prophet. To be effective, prophets have to embrace a compelling vision of the future. Prophets are fueled by a compelling vision of the future. Every successful prophet embraces a God-given vision of an ideal future state that they absolutely believe to the depths of their being, we will get to someday. And it's that vision that fuels them no matter what. You know the speech. 1963, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, looking out at hundreds of thousands of people who had participated in the March on Washington. And near the end of his speech, he goes off script and begins to ad lib some of the most famous words in the history of American speeches. He was able to do this ad lib because what he was talking about in that moment was the vision that God had planted so deep within him, that he was so certain of, that it filled every fiber of his being. As he looked out at prophets, activists, who are looking for a reason to go on, Dr. King said to them, you know the words, let us not wallow in the valley of despair. Even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It's a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having lips dripping with words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. And it was that dream that gave Dr. King the strength to keep coming back again and again, despite the death threats, despite FBI harassment, despite so many defeats, despite seeing so many of his fellow prophets harmed and struggle. It was the dream that kept him going for the next 5 years until in 1968, the night before his assassination, looking out at a packed church of people, prophets who needed encouragement. It's as if he had a premonition of what the next day would bring, because as he looked out at that congregation of prophets, he said to them the night before his death, "We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop." He told them the story of Moses. Moses, who had struggled with the Israelites to free them from Egypt, who had struggled in the wilderness for 40 years to get them to the land of promise. The end of Moses' life was near, and so he went up to the mountain and he looked out into the land of promise, knowing that he himself would never get there in his lifetime. So Dr. King told them that story. He said, "It doesn't matter with me now because I too have been up to the mountaintop. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." There it is. Every great prophet is fueled by a vision so beautiful, so compelling, that he or she says, "Whatever it takes, however long it takes, we will get there as a people. And I want to be a part of that." The great prophet Isaiah, he too had a vision that, when you think about it, is remarkably similar to Dr. King's vision. Here's how Isaiah put it, Isaiah 11:6. "He foresaw a day when the wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord." Isaiah was foreseeing a day when animosities would end. Animal versus animal. Animal versus human. Human versus human. He was foreseeing a day when a lion and a lamb would be best friends, lie down together, share the earth in peace as equals, the predator and the prey, the one with all the power and the one that was victimized, the oppressor and the oppressed, a lion and a lamb, symbolic of all that has created brokenness and division here on the face of the earth. Isaiah foresaw a day when all of that was going to be history. And the vision will finally be realized. I want to encourage you with that vision today, because that's what will keep us going. And in that spirit, to help us try to vividly picture the vision in our hearts, I want to show you in closing a brief video that, to me, captures the feel, the essence, the substance of Isaiah and Dr. King's vision of what is coming. Watch this. Thank you. Mark my word. Mark the word of the prophets. The day it's coming. It's the heavenly vision, and oh, what a day that will be. But meanwhile, we have been put down here on earth for a purpose, and our job as prophets of God is to see how close we can get our nation to living in to that heavenly vision. It's God's work, it's God's will. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Goethe once said, he or she who has never despaired has never lived. Dr. Cornel West adds, it's okay to despair, but never give it the last word. My fellow prophets, if you're tired today, if you're tempted to despair that we will ever get there, if you are weary, I want to encourage you today. I want to feed your spirit. I want to remind you of the vision. Let that vision renew your spirit and fuel you as we go forward with the struggle. Whatever it takes, however long it takes, we will get there as a people. Let's make sure we do our part.